Luke Mankney is joining us at Parallax to talk about his upcoming course, which begins on January the 6th. January the 6th and the 7th for people in Melbourne, because you're from Melbourne. So it would be January 6th is a Saturday, first Saturday of the month. We usually begin our courses, our month-long courses at Parallax. And you're going to be talking about Gurdjieff. And the course is called The Hard Way. So I thought today, you know, I could ask you first about the title, because I find the title beautifully provocative. It's what nobody wants anymore, but it's what we need. And and I also want to go through the different modules that you proposed, which are sleep and awakening, sex and soul, God and service. So how does that sound?
No, that sounds good. And it is a one-time course. I think we spoke about this earlier. And for good reason, not to replicate anything, but to see if there is an opportunity, a point in time, to really work with something, and not wishing to have it replicated again at some point in the future. That doesn't mean that the material might not be covered in some way, shape, or form, but the course as it's structured and as it's formed won't happen again. So this is a last time exclusive offer. To your question,
one time limited offer is what you love, which I love, because it's so marketing, and yet it's the hard way. So that's about as bad marketing as you could get.
It is, yeah.
You're trying to convince somebody to do a course, you know, that's, you know, difficult, you know, and then, but it's a one time limited offer that might, you know, be a hook.
Might be a hook. Yeah. The title, the Hard Way, it really comes from my experience, and certainly others that I've worked with over a long time. But also there seems to be this current theme, particularly on the internet, that this spiritual stuff is relatively easy as long as you follow the 12 kind of phases, or you read a book, or you attend a course, or there seems to be something very alluring, but also something very easy. I've always found it odd that we accept that if we want to be a lawyer or a doctor or go into a vocation, that it's generally a long period of time with which to train, to prepare. And it's something that is not going to be easy. You've got to spend a lot of time, energy, and effort. But when it comes to my own transformation, spiritually speaking, that this should all be free and easy. And so this title of A Hard Way kind of gets to the nub of the question. It's not easy, but that's the good news. If one can accept that what I'm trying is not easy, that it is the hard way, then most of one's problems are solved, because trying to move into anything that's relatively easy, you expect it to be easy. But when you start to come across kind of barriers or blockages, rather than being able to see them as challenges and opportunities, one shirks away from it. So this hard way, this course is just to let everybody know that that it is hard. Life generally is hard. That doesn't mean there's no joy or no happiness or peace, but to accept that it's a hard way. And what does that mean? Very, very practically, what does that mean? What does that mean in terms of changing my orientation, my approach, and also being able to assess the material that's out there? What appears to be easy as opposed to appearing to be hard? What's the reality? It's like anything. If you're wanting to do a course at university, or if you're wanting to go into business, you have to evaluate. You have to evaluate, how do I approach this? What are the things that might be needed? So that's the title, The Hard Way. And as you said a little bit earlier, it's not the most well-formed marketing tool, because it's not saying the word easy in there, or it's not something alluring and that people will get something out of it of what they normally expect. But there might be something else
Yeah.
get out of it.
Well, I have a sense that we need to be kind of anti-marketing in some way if we're heading towards the truth. Like we have to go against the current. Now, as you were speaking, I was thinking of a couple things. I was thinking about in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, they talk about when you die, you can go towards the bright and shiny, alluring light, or you can go towards the clear light. And most of the time we go towards the bright and shiny, alluring kind of, and we get dazzled by something that seems to be like immediately gratifying, and we miss the clear light, which is infinitely deeper and more profound.
No, it's and I think it's natural to go towards the shiny toys, right? There's something there to play with. Oh, this is sort of wonderful. But and those really heartfelt moments, those moments of vulnerability, those moments where you may have hit kind of bottom, there's something else that kind of appears there. It's like all of the shininess gives way or gets parked, and something else can come through. And that kind of goes to that first module around sleep and awakening, where Gurdjieff was quite emphatic that really what prevents us from living a full life, being really engaged with life, is this notion of sleep, that somehow there's something inside of me which is very, very kind of passive. And why is that? Why is that at a very practical level? Not just to say that we're asleep or we're in dreams, but why? Why is that? And if we could somehow awaken a little bit out of that, whatever those two words mean, that life might be a little different. And even in our own lives, we see that there are moments of quality, and sometimes it could be in moments of trauma or in moments of joy. But there's something that becomes a bit alive in us. All of a sudden, we see things in a bit of a different way. That doesn't mean we're enlightened and all of a sudden we understand everything, but there's something more alive in us. This quality, what is that practically? What is that quality that comes and goes? And so to look at that in a very different way, without all of the shackles and all of the loaded meanings, is something that can become clear. If I go back to what you're saying, this clear light, what does it mean to have clarity? And in those moments when I just come out of that sleep a little bit, things become clearer. There's something about my awareness, something about my body, my feeling that there's this clarity. And then I drop back into sleep again, or something resembling it. And so if there's an opportunity to maybe work with that, and see that, then who knows what the possibilities are.
Yeah, I was thinking about in my own experience, I would also say sleep is like laziness. And I remember Carl Jung saying that, the biggest evil is laziness. It's not these heinous acts that they're almost they come from inadvertence, or laziness. That's the source of it. It's just not wanting to be here, or wanting to live in this mechanical state, and then not taking this little opening of luminous clear light that is being presented us, and making that our meaning.
Yes, I mean, I know for me, I've said and done a lot of stupid things. And the regret and the remorse afterwards, because I know better. Why did I say that? Why did I hurt that person? Why did I do this insane stuff? I knew it wasn't helpful, but yet there was something in me that was blinded. And then it's only afterwards I feel this deep remorse. Why? And it seems that my whole life is just a series of saying and doing a lot of dumb things. And so there's this real question, why? Why at that moment is there something lost in me that just goes with this?
Yeah, it's always a moment, hey?
Yeah, it's a moment and I'm kind of taken away. I ignite the bomb and then there's this carnage. And then I'm left with needing to pick up the pieces when I know, why did I say that? Why? That was just dumb. That, you know, that wasn't helpful. So there's something in me that knows, but then there's something in me that acts very contrary to it. Why is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is sort of a great mystery. What is it in us that, you know, what is it in us that is against us on some level, right? You know, it seems to be against our better interest it seems very difficult to break through this Gordian knot of our own inadvertence and, you know, acting in ways that are not helpful to ourselves and others.
Yeah, and it really speaks to those powerful forces in us. And, you know, there's one moment I wish for this wholeness and this peace and a relationship with my neighbor. And then at another moment, I just want to go to the pub and get drunk and do all sorts of, you know, nutty stuff. But if one can find a way to be there, there are some interesting forces at play, something that pushes me somewhere and something that calls me to a different place. But so I'm often not aware of it.
Excuse me, yeah. So is it choosing to be in another place than the pub which matters, or is it the awareness that you have in the pub or in the other place that matters? You know,
well,
because like we try to choose, like, oh, this is better and this is, you know, but this preference between things, maybe it's even more profound to be doing what Gurdjieff called self-remembrance practice in the pub.
Yes. And I've had those experiences. I can remember coming from a retreat once and, the only thing I wanted to do was go down to the pub or go to a party. And I remember being at the party or the pub and feeling remorse. What drove me here? Like, I just come from this experience where there was a real quietness and this clarity, and then yet this other force which I was just unaware of that pushed me into a certain place. And then that, as you're saying, well, I'm now in the midst of it. I'm now at the pub. Okay, how do I be here? How do I bring that other experience into this one so I can be more engaged? So it's not so much a preference between good and bad. It's how did I arrive here? Was I able to see that, whether it's at a pub or whether it's in a temple or on retreat or at a job or on the toilet? Or eating in a restaurant. It's not so much where I am, but can I be there wherever I've arrived? And I think that for me is the mystery. I somehow get there, something pushes me, and then I wonder, how did I get here? Well, while I'm there, I should be making use of it. Mm-hmm. How do I be more present? How do I enliven something? To be more awake and less asleep to the situation that I'm in. And my experience of that going to the pub is the beer I had or two was wonderful. rather than just chucking them down, I actually tasted it. You know,
Yeah.
I was there with it more. That was, you know, a revelation to me. Normally when I do any of that, if I eat or if I drink, it's just throwing it down. It's just consuming. But yet I was shown there was a different way. I can be with that. I can be with my beer. And so
yeah,
beer
that's good. That's good.
A whole new flavor.
Because usually we want to reject the world. You know, there's a tendency to want to go into a special kind of situation and then be there forever, but we can't do that. And also we can't just be in this turbulent, that's a French word. We can't be in this chaos all the time without having moments where we leave. And so I think an oscillation between, let's say, the retreat and the world is the best way to live, from my perspective.
Yes, and certainly for Gurdjieff, having both feet firmly planted in earth and heaven, you know, is a full way to live. One or the other, we tend to hop around, but to really walk, to be firmly planted in either. But yes, I yo-yo though, and I think that's what it's like early on in, say, one's journey. One yo-yos, you know. There's moments. Oh yes, I need to follow a path, and I wish for something, and then the next moment I'm carried away with whatever, until something begins to start to coalesce, or at least begin to meet in me, and to begin to understand, yeah, I need to bring these worlds together in me.
Yeah.
How do I do that?
Yeah, I mean, you're a family guy, right? You have a family and you run businesses, and so you're not living in a cave in Tibet somewhere. You're right in the thick of it. Do you find that a challenge? I mean, it's the hard way, so it is a challenge. But just like, let's say, spiritual practice and family worldly life. I think it's part of Gurdjieff's kind of emphasis, being able to do that in the world, that being the fourth way. Is that speak to you, or?
Yes, no, it does. And that's, you know, why he mentions this hard way requires a lot. Most other spiritual ways, yes, you can go into a cave or, you know, somewhere. You tend to isolate yourself away from life, whether it's for a time or for your lifetime. But you take yourself out of the conditions with which you find yourself. For him, it was no. You need to see where you're at. And certainly for me, to be able to bring a spiritual practice right in the midst of my family life, business, and to do that intelligently, is very, very difficult right from word go.
Yeah.
Because you come up against all sorts of things. So one of the things one learns on the hard way is to be in credit with your family. It's a saying that if I wish to go away on a retreat, or there's something I wish to try, or I wish to meet up with someone, or I need to have time to read a book or whatever it is, and that takes you away from family or business, then you need to be in credit. What does that mean? Well, you need to work for your family, work for your business to create that space that I can then give to myself. So there's a work
that's
before
sure.
it even works, you know.
Yeah, because I always find that the activities of the family create a complete practice environment already. You know,
yes.
There was a Zen teacher I met who used to say that it was like, for the Western people, a family is like a monastery. In the sense, all the parameters are there. You have children, you have jobs, you have, you know, there's always something to do. There's not this all this time. So you have to really work to use your time in a clear way, and so time becomes very precious and important. And you can easily, again, you can easily just get tired, right? Get burned out and find yourself asleep again, right? In
Yes.
front of the television, or, you know, and letting things slide, or, but you always have to get back up and, you know.
Yes. And if one's not careful, to find a way to include family and business, it doesn't have to be in an obvious way. You don't have to preach to anyone, but how do I use the material of life for my own work in that sense? Otherwise, a schism gets created. I start to resent my family and business. Oh, it's taking me away from my spiritual practice. And you see this schism a great deal, where people eventually go off to some kind of commune to escape. And that's real escapism, and at least for me, not healthy. But to find a way to integrate also gives a bit of a glimpse of just how hard the hard way is, not only for my own life, but just the way that the world works. It's hard to change anything. I mean, to have real change, because there's something that's needed.
Mm-hmm.
There might be fashions that come and go, but real change is difficult. And to experience that, start at home. Start at home. How do I work with my family, my business, friends?
Mm. Absolutely. Well, I was thinking, you mentioned credit, and I was also thinking about this idea of being obligation debt. I think that's a Gurdjieffian notion.
Yeah.
That we have a being obligation debt that we have to pay off. So there's, how do we pay off that debt?
Well, that's a good question. I find it strange. We come in with a great gift into life, a body. We're given a body. I didn't create it, and I'm pretty sure you didn't. But yet we're here, and there's this vehicle, this support kind of mechanism, if you'd like, that's provided to us. That's our first gift. In a sense, we're in debt to it. This thing that carries me and supports me my entire life. Without a body, what am I? And so one of the obligations is I need to understand my body, because it's made of all of the forces and energies of the universe. I mean, kind of literally. And so if I can begin to have a sense of, well, what is this gift, this body, and why have I been provided this gift? And like any gift, if you want to understand it, you've got to look at it. You've got to try to work out its parts, how it relates, all of those things.
Yeah.
So in a sense,
you said look at it.
Yeah.
You didn't say like go to the gym and build big muscles and become a super yogi or something like that. I think this is a question of awareness, isn't it?
It's a question of, well, what's here? I mean, yes, you know, one needs to keep up a certain level of fitness and health to keep the body working, but that can be done in a way that's very unhealthy. If you're always at the gym, you're always trying to shape this kind of body into something, trying to manipulate it rather than really looking at it. Well, okay, what's here? How is it speaking to me? And it won't speak in English or French. It will speak in its language. And to begin to understand it, it's, and often, you know, you, and I'm the same way. I don't tend to listen to my body until something breaks in it. You know, it might be screaming out to me and I ignore it. You know, I push on. But, well, maybe it's saying something. Maybe those aches and pains are its language that's trying to speak to me.
Mm-hmm.
But we've, in our modern culture, we've, you know, the body is bad. The body is just a thing. It's just an object. And the mind is really where it's all at. But that's really to ignore a gift. And to ignore a gift is, you know,
a problem. Yeah.
Yeah. The problem is I need to be here and study it. And maybe maybe really looking at the body and trying to have a sense of its needs might help inform me on other things. Who knows? It's open question.
When you said that, when it's almost like that's the definition of sin or something, is to ignore the gift.
Yeah. And particularly a gift that's freely given, to ignore it. Wow, that's what an insult
terrible
to the giver.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that should make us humble. And it's only when we begin to be ill or injured that we have a much clearer sense of how much we rely upon the body and how much we've ignored it.
Yep.
That we start to look inwards. So illness and injury can actually be a great catalyst for that looking inward. But even then, it's often short-lived with people, and then they kind of carry on rather than, wow, I've been given an opportunity to listen to my body.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what about that's, let's say that covers some of the things related to the first unit, sleep and awakening.
Yeah.
Maybe we can look at your second unit, which is called sex and soul. So I don't think I know what Gurdjieff has to say about sexuality. I have some inkling perhaps of what he might say about it, but that doesn't seem to be like something that would be obvious to me in his teaching. So I'm curious about what that is, and also what he means by a soul. So
yes, well, I mean, just broadly, he says we really don't understand sex. We think we do, but it's a very potent life force, something that comes from a very high place to really give life to life. It powers everything. And so for him, it's almost an illusion that we have any sense that we can control it or do anything with it. But it can be a force in which we can start to see work in us and appreciate. And for Gurdjieff, the energy of sex, just generally right across the board, isn't able to work properly in us. And the main reason for that is that we're not harmonized. We're out of whack, out of balance. We're lopsided. So this very high, very powerful energy, which should be there to help form a soul, a vehicle for something else, really gets out of place, higgledy-piggledy. And he calls this really the abuse of sex. And we're all prone to it, because we are born and live into a life where we are tossed around and we don't really pay any attention to it. And so these very high energies, rather than being able to find a home in us, find its rightful place, often then go to wrong places,
mm-hmm.
into addictions, into abuse, into vehemence, even in the body, going into the twitches, the fidgets. You know, you see someone who's twitching their leg a lot, or they're constantly moving. It's this energy that can't find a home, and so it has to come out of us in some way, shape, or form.
Mm-hmm.
And a normal way is through the act of sex. That's a way to help eliminate or to remove that excess from us. And you know, in our modern world and in the world period, you look at how sex is used.
Yeah, but that becomes a kind of compulsive act that's not married to anything more profound. Yeah.
But yet it's, for most people, it's one of the closest experiences they'll get to a spiritual one.
Yeah.
And it drives so much. Not so much because of the arousal level, but there's moments in the experience of sex where I'm free from myself, and yet myself, and yet also in a way immersed with the other. It's a very interesting experience. And because we can't be nourished in any other way, often in modern life, then we seek out those experiences, and sex is one way to do that. And of course there's others, there's addictions and everything else, but that's in a sense what he calls the abuse, because we don't understand it. We don't understand that this energy needs to find a place. So we need to put our house in order first. And then this energy will find its place. And so that's where most of his work is being able to balance something and not trying to manipulate.
Yeah, that's a tricky point, right? Because there's lots of manipulation, I think. Even if it when you combine spirituality and sex. So, you know, in these tantric schools and things like that. But it's a very, on the other hand, sexuality is quite simple as well. There's a simplicity to it. And I think people try to make it complicated, as you know, in a myriad of ways.
All these, you know, rules and sort of regulations. And I know for Gurdjieff that, you know, he essentially said that there were no rules. You needed to find out for yourself what your needs are.
Yeah.
But very much from a practical point of view, not because of the fashion of the day, because that comes and goes. It's what do I need? How do I see this working in me? Mm-hmm. And if I see something going awry, okay, it's not that I attempt to change the energy of sex. It's maybe there's something that's where it's not finding its place in me. Okay, maybe there's something I can work on there. So in a way, it's a humbleness, it's an awe that this potent energy I need to be very respectful of, because it can take me to all sorts of places, you know.
Yeah.
And I've certainly experienced this myself when it works in all sorts of odd ways. You know, that force is so strong, I'm chasing after the next pretty piece, you know. I'm wanting to have that next conquest, because that force is so powerful. And then that can turn into the competition in business and wanting to win and all of this stuff that can flow out of this energy just not finding a healthy place in us. So it's a big question.
Yeah,
so for
sure.
Gurdjieff, it's about just trying to reset things a little and maybe approaching it from a bit of a different way without all of the shackles around it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember hearing something from the Sufis that talk about, you know, how we need to create this kind of substance that is like a samadhi, a concentrated substance. And that is sort of like that is kind of giving the life gift. And if we don't do that, then things go awry. And you know, that kind of samadhi sense that you get in deep meditation or in deep sexuality is almost like that. It's almost like this is what gives us life instead of keeps us in the mechanical or the, you know, the gray or the, you know, the sleep.
Yes, yes. And it's constantly flowing through us.
Mm.
We can't turn off the tap. This energy, it fuels everything. And so we either find a way to work with it and see, or it takes over. And often in life, that's not always a healthy thing, just because of the consequences of life.
Mm-hmm. Very good. So we've covered sex. What about the soul?
Well, and sex is very much, in a sense, related to this growth or formation of the soul. For Gurdjieff, the soul was very matter of fact, very, very practical. It's probably more akin in English to the word maturing. You know, we have this sense in English that when we say, oh, someone's mature, or they're more mature than what their years say, or they're immature, even though they might be old. Well, what do we mean by that? What does this word mature means? It's, and there's not too many English words which express that sense, the beingness of someone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, someone might be
a mature beingness.
Yeah. What does that mean? In a sense, it means that something is connected or related in a different way. Something's more coherent.
Yeah.
We use that term. Well, what is that? Well, it's not just my body. I mean, once you get past youth, generally your body starts to go downhill. It's kind of falling apart rather than being more intact. So it can't be anything to do with the body. And so that when it comes to feeling, okay, what does that mean when we say someone's mature, particularly if, you know, they're in a leadership role, people are looking for someone who's mature. What does that mean? Does it mean that it's in control of, say, one's emotions, or does it mean something else? It's such an elusive term, but when we talk about it, we have this innate sense that we know what the word mature means. We have a sense of it, but it's very hard to articulate.
Do you think the soul grows as the body kind of falls apart as you grow older? Is there a growth process of the soul while the body, at least a possibility of that?
Yes. And for Gurdjieff, the body, if you'd like, is a bit of a chrysalis. You know, it's he calls the various aspects of the soul bodies.
Yeah.
We have our first body, which is the physical body. You know, it grows from a single cell and goes through this wonderful growth phase and matures, and we go through puberty. And he says that the other parts of the soul are completely analogous to that, that there's an inception or a conception period, and then something is able to grow, and it's if the conditions are right. And we have that with the physical body. You know, you need to eat, you need to take care of yourself. If you can, the conditions around you, you live in a hot climate, a cold climate. So while there's something that's striving to grow, it requires the conditions to grow in a healthy way. And the same thing for the soul. And so there really becomes a question, well, what do these various parts of this maturing phase need? And in ancient days, there was a real sense of that at every life phase, there was something that was needed for the soul.
Mm-hmm.
So the sense of retirement, you know, in the Western world now, retirement is essentially quit your job and kind of do all those things that you couldn't do in your youth, right? Because you've had...
But then you're too old to really enjoy it. You're too tired and burnt out from your job to enjoy them. It's kind of like, it's very sad. Yeah. I remember like the Tibetans came over and looked at Western people who had worked there, you know, and they've just felt very sad because in their culture that, you know, there is a huge nobility to age.
Mm.
Whereas age in the West is a denigration or something, or degradation is
looking for. Well, it's this worship of the body. It's this trying to keep youthful. And that really means that, you know, we've lost something, that age, and particularly older age, this maturing process, and particularly in retirement where one withdraws from the active life a bit, is not to try to rekindle the days of youth, but there's something important that needs to happen before I die. You know, there's something else that needs to be matured. And we've sort of lost that in this Western culture as we strive to keep ourselves young, and that really is, in a sense, lacks a certain obligation to ourselves, that the body is transient. It's a temporary thing, and what is the next thing that can emerge out of it? And that really requires something to be observed and studied right from youth, and cultivated and educated that our older age is very important. Maybe our older age is even more important than our youth, because there's something that's pressing. I need to accomplish something before I die. Well, what is that? You know, you see in Western culture this midlife crisis. People get to their 40s and, you know, it's all, what have I done with my life? And the natural inclination is to try to relive youth. You know,
it's terrible.
It's a tragedy. Something very coarse happens, and we're at this finer material that can be with us. And once we begin to have this sense that the body is just a temporary vehicle, an important one, but it makes way for something else, then there's a different relationship with the body, and something else can appear that maybe is more valuable.
So that would be the soul.
And that would be this thing that we call the soul. But
this thing that we call the soul, yeah.
In Gurdjieff's sense, it needs to be practical, not just an idea of something that exists somewhere.
Right, because that would create this kind of intense dualism that we have a problem with in the West, is like the soul is over here and the body is here. And
Yeah, the soul, in a sense, or the various parts of it need the body. It needs to be nourished by the body. The body is the vehicle for it.
Or the soul is body too, right? The soul is, as you say, the soul is a body. In Buddhism, there's three bodies, the Dharmakaya, Sambhogakaya, Nirmanakaya, and one is the you know, this, and then there's the subtle body, and then there's, you know, the Dharmakaya, which is just the space, I guess, the context of everything, and that, but they're all considered bodies. They're not separate from each other, and they don't live in different realms. It's all a singularity, I would say.
And that's for Gurdjieff one of the unique things of human life, and he speaks about this in his books on kind of beings of other planets who don't have a body, or they have a different kind of body. But we humans are blessed. We can have three bodies, all in one, all helping each other, relating to each other. Mm-hmm. You know, and he says that's quite unique in the universe. And so rather than this kind of dualist, of we've got the body and we've got the soul,
because three brains, so brain, that means intelligent bodies. They're not inert matter. They're forms of intelligence, right? The three brains.
Yes. And this comes down to the various energies and qualities that these parts of the soul can engage certain qualities of energies that the other parts can't. You know, so that sense that we're talking about in sleep and awakening, when I awaken a little bit, or I'm a little bit less asleep, there's something in me, in a sense, that is able to tap into that quality. When I'm just in the body will do what it does. It survives, and it does a pretty good job of that. So it becomes this question of, well, these qualities can appear because there's something resonant which they can appear in, these aspects of the soul. So there's a resonance here. There's a resonance between, I now have a measuring stick, if you'd like, that if these qualities can appear, it means that there's something else forming in me that allows those qualities to appear or be sustained.
Is it a question of creating a context or a space for them, to allowing them to appear? Or is it a question of constructing anything, or is it just as a question of sort of letting, let's say, the soul appear, or the spirit appear, or whatever you want to call it?
Yes. Well, there seems to be a number of things. There's in a sense no rules or formula. There's certainly that's required. There's an effort that's required on my part. There's also the conditions that allow that effort to be useful. And then there's also something that we have absolutely no control over, and that is done by, in the Christian sense, grace. Because there is something in us that is wishing to move upwardly, not in a hierarchical sense, but to bring these qualities out. But I often get in the way, or I don't make the necessary efforts, or the conditions aren't helpful. So there's an intelligence to be brought to this, something required from me, something I need to support in the conditions of my life. And then there's something, like we were speaking about the potency of sex, which I have no control over, but yet I need to find a way to be receptive to or try to get out of the way of. So it's,
that's what I'm getting at, kind of trying to get out of the way of it's often the work is not often a constructive but a deconstructive act.
Yes,
of getting out of the way.
Yeah,
maybe that brings us to the next subject, which is God in service.
Yes.
So what the hell is God and what are we serving? And it's a funny thing, I was thinking about this. It's almost easier now to talk about these things than it was like 10 years ago.
Yeah.
To people, yeah. Because I feel like religion is coming back. I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm not as embarrassed, to use the G word before. I mean, it's just a word. And I almost feel that it needs to come back or something to this world.
Yeah. Yes.
Does that make
yes.
sense?
Yes. No, it does. God has always
and service
been
as well, right? The sense of serving God, like what the fuck is that? I mean, for an atheist, I mean, it just has no sense, right? It sounds like some sort of slavery to a fundamentalist principle, but that's not what it is.
Yes, and it's strange. All of the atheist arguments are not arguments for atheism. They're arguments against theism, which is interesting. Doesn't really follow the method of science, but anyway, that's another conversation.
That's a whole other conversation. but I don't even think that conversation is necessary anymore.
No.
For a lot of people, it's like been there, done that. So now we can talk about God in service again.
Yes,
hilariously enough.
And there's in it, at least for me, there's this true sense of I either am trying to serve something higher or I'm just serving something lower or just myself. It becomes that stark.
That Bob Dylan song, that song?
Yeah.
You have to serve something. You're either serving something greater, more fantastic, more beautiful, more divine, or you're just serving your banal needs, or you're serving something terrible. You're always serving something.
Yeah.
You're always in a movement or in a movement of service, I think.
Yes. And Gurdjieff uses the word being a conscious slave. We're born into this world and something is needed from us, whether we're conscious to it or not. And so it's whether one can transform from a slave into a servant. And the difference between a slave and a servant is just one is more conscious of the role that they're playing. But also this sense from Gurdjieff that this need to serve and the ability to serve is really at the apex of work. If we can accept that we don't serve now, and we can't because we're trapped into this sleep-like self-serve phase, but we feel this sense of needing to serve something else because it allows us to go out of ourselves a little while not rejecting ourselves. Because in service to something higher, I am needed.
Well, we talked about sex too. I mean, what is sex but that?
Yeah, Yeah,
And
this
anyway, sorry
it's
to jump in and like interrupt like that,
no,
but
but
I
this
just like was making the connection between sex and services, at its most profound sense, that's what it is. If it's in its most banal sense, it's just getting your rocks off.
yeah.
And there's a like such a big difference between those two things.
Yes, there's, it's such a subtle but very interesting relationship between sex, soul, and service. It's these three interesting kind of elements. But this notion of service is really needing to accept, I can't serve now, but if there is a wish, what does it mean to serve? To really serve. Not just to pay lip service to it. What does it mean to really serve? We all aspire to serve God, but maybe we need to lower the aim a little. And maybe this comes back to what we were saying earlier. How do I serve my family? How do I serve my brother, my sister, my father, my mother? How do I serve my colleagues, my business? Bringing it right back and really trying to delve into what does this mean to serve, particularly when it's inconvenient, particularly when I don't want to serve, even at the littlest level, might give a bit of a glimpse of what service might mean as it expands. So beyond the family, beyond business, beyond my community, maybe eventually to God. So this notion of we think that we can just serve God because we wish it needs to be shattered. We need to be humbled a bit and go, well, can we just serve our neighbor? And maybe that might give us a bit of a glimpse of what's needed. And I'm sure if we could do that, the whole world would change. But
Makes perfect sense.
and part and parcel of that, and we'll delve into this into the course more, is with service, in a sense, moving towards that notion of service is suffering, which is a bit of a dirty word. It's like the word God. What does it mean to suffer? I mean, to really look at it as impartially as we can and as practically as we possibly can, what does it mean to suffer? And this other sense that Gurdjieff brings into it, it's called conscious labors. So how do I suffer and work consciously? Which is not a dirty word. It's not anything that he puts around it as something of a chore or a drudgery that we have to go through life. He certainly puts this in context of obligation. I'm somehow obliged. It's my duty. It's my duty to undergo this.
Yeah,
Not that I
because
wish or
work is
want
what
for.
we don't want to do in a way, right?
Yeah, I certainly don't want to work. I don't want to suffer. I don't want to feel pain, but I don't really know what I want. It's interesting. And we chase our tails. But to
Well,
accept that a little, it changes something. It
yeah,
changes.
it changes something. Actually, I remember a karate teacher told me once, he just said, that's what work is, doing the thing you don't really want to do. And it's so true. I mean, we don't really want to, do the exercises or write the paper, or we'd rather just be, drinking margaritas or something by some poolside, all day long. But then we would, but then we, that would not satisfy us. So we need, so then we would suffer. And so when we suffer, we realize that, oh, we can either suffer consciously or unconsciously. Like, we have that choice. We can either suffer asleep, which is something terrible, or we can go through the sufferings of life, because life is hard, and have an enormous amount of meaning in that kind of suffering.
And that practical approach to suffering. I mean, what does it really mean to suffer? I mean, and we feel that in the body, and we feel it in our feelings, and we can feel it in our mind. But what is those qualities of energies that bring about this experience of suffering, which can change in a heartbeat? I can remember a very early experience I had when I was a teenager. I hated going to school. So for the 6 hours I was there, it was just hell on earth, painful. Everything was boring. And yet after that, I would then go off and I'd be training for sports because I used to love sports back then, and 3 or 4 hours of training and all sorts of stuff. And I'd love it, and I'd want more of it. And I'd get up the next morning. But for that 6 hours during the day, I just hated it. And that suddenly hit me. I spend far more energy and time doing this stuff that I love, and yet this other stuff that I don't like seems to just drain the hell out of me. I hated it. Why? And it was just this change in attitude. What is it that I didn't like about that thing as opposed to about that thing? So it was nothing to do with energy. You know, something that I don't like drains me because it's hard. It was just my approach to it. And so that really brought a question. Well, what do I really don't like? And I found for me that as I get older, there is more things that I don't like to do.
Like, I don't like doing my taxes. I avoid them. Like, I don't like putting numbers into Excel files and making calculations and doing budgets. And I mean, that's just, I'd rather stick pens in my eyeballs than do that. So it takes so much conscious suffering for me to go and do that one thing. But when I do that, I feel better because I've done it.
Yeah.
And I need to do it. And if I don't do it, I suffer. So.
Yeah, you're caught between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, it's interesting that over time, if you only just keep doing the things that you like, how much your world just grows smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah.
To begin to look at and maybe even embrace, you may not need to like it, but embrace all of the things that I don't like, and to really, to practically look at why is it that I don't like that? What is it in me, this experience, that all of a sudden life can enlarge, you know, because I go from not minding so much that I don't like it, like having to do your taxes. And I certainly have to do a lot of book work, and it's the last thing I want to do. But it also provides me an opportunity. Why is it that I don't like it? Can I bring myself to it in a different way? And that requires something very conscious. If I like it, generally I'm a lot more asleep because I'm carried away with the current of liking.
Yes,
but if I yes. don't like it, I've got to come to it more consciously because I'm very aware of the not liking. And so I need to navigate that. So it's interesting.
Yeah. I was thinking about how, like, learning an instrument, a guitar, and when you start, you really don't, it's really, your fingers are bleeding and, you know, and you're out of tune and you're just, it's terrible. Mm-hmm. It's just absolutely terrible. But then when you persist in that, and even when you've persisted in that and become somewhat a good player of your instrument, you still have to keep pushing an edge there, or you just get bored, right? You still have to make things difficult for yourself. You still have to push towards a hard way. Otherwise, you know, you just become habitual in how you do things. So I think it's about change. It's about pushing against your habit fields.
Yes. Being in just always searching to be a little uncomfortable, to stretch yourself. If you do it too much, you can do more harm than good. But yes, this striving, this searching, which brings with it that uncomfortableness, because it's unknown. It's unknown. How am I going to be with this? What's the next thing. Maybe I work at something not knowing what the result is, but I work at it anyway because I have a sense that if I don't, I know I'm just going to slide backwards, or I'm going to be even more asleep because I'm too comfortable. And so that, and in a sense, that's that intelligence that says, this is what it means to be alive, to be in between. Yes, I'm all of this stuff that life has produced in me and all of my experiences, but there's this little spark that I need to keep alive that allows me to just stretch a little, be a little uncomfortable with, to step into that unknown cautiously and carefully, but yet it's unknown. And then something very alive can happen. Yeah. But if I'm cut off from that and it's just Groundhog Day every day, that is really, for me, the true meaning of hell.
Yeah.
No matter how much wealth, how much health, it kills something.
Yeah. 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 And it's almost the opposite direction of everything, you know, because everybody's looking for happiness and success and ease and comfort. And like, that's what we want. That's what we're looking for on some like we're just trying to be safe and, you know, but then I guess the heroic thing is turning towards our anxiety or turning towards our terrors or turning towards the things that are just basically uncomfortable. That's weirdly how we get joy, I think. It's like, it's a weird sort of paradox.
Yes. Yeah. And it's a shame in this modern world that, you know, we have abundance. It's in Western worlds, you know, we have a general level of health and wealth that we've never seen in the world yet. It can allow us at least the opportunity to face all those anxieties inside. And what do? We anaesthetize it, you know, with drugs or all sorts of things that take us away from, okay, this is what it means to be human. When I don't have to worry about where my next meal is coming from so much, and then I know I can at least be supported in living a longish life. What's next? Well, what's next is what most people in the world have never really had, is this opportunity to come inward, because most of their life is just about surviving. Well, that should be a privilege for us, and we should be moving towards that. Okay, anxiety or whatever else, let's take a good look at it, move positively towards it, and see it as
spiritual life.
That's the spiritual life.
The beginning of the spiritual life, right? Which, you know, that is kind of perennial. That's what we should be doing. I agree. We need to get that back. In a way, we need to get that back in the culture.
And that's what the West can really bring, because we're not so much concerned with the other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean that there is not a need to address issues in relation to health and wealth. There are still plenty of them, but what a privilege. We have a time that most people, if supported, can really take on the inner life, really take on the spiritual quest. And instead, we go the other way and squabble and fight over all sorts of crazy things, which are temporary and generally meaningless.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So you'll there'll be three sessions, we've kind of covered the three sessions, and then you'll also be doing a one-on-one meeting with people. What will you do in that? How do you work with people? I'm curious.
Well, it's yeah. There's no formula. It's just the meeting of two people who can share questions or might want to delve into something a little bit more that maybe wasn't either afforded to them, or they weren't ready to speak about that during the course, or something that's just come up in the course of time. But really to work with someone one-on-one is, and for me, this is a work as well as a work for them in the sense of needing to meet. It's just a work of being able to meet where we're at. What is it that why are we meeting? what's here that we wish to explore or exchange, and allow that to emerge organically, not to impose anything on it, but also a hope that out of that one-on-one, that there might be something of a more personal nature that could be touched upon, and some material provided that could be helpful when they exit the course. There's no so much a time limit on it. It might be 5 minutes, might be hours. It's really up to the participants of what they want to explore. So it's very, very free form.
Very nice. I think it's going to be wonderful. So I hope, besides being the hard way is the wonderful way as well, right? Is it not?
Yeah.
It's not just a hardness that is nihilistic, that just, drags. It's the hardness of facing, you know, the aliveness of one's existence.
Yeah. And I've found for me that, you know, the hard way helps to soften the way.
Yeah, exactly.
I can come into a new relationship with myself, because I most of my life is just really about refusing things. But to begin to change something from refusing to acceptance in an intelligent and mature way, there's a lot of energy that becomes available, because I spend so much time resisting everything. So that hard way, while it might be hard, while it might be difficult, I have found, not only for myself and others, but is in a way the quickest way to softening up the inner life, so I can come into a different relationship with myself and others. And that I find is the miracle of the Gurdjieff work. Mm-hmm. And really any other sincere and genuine work.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a nice place to conclude our conversation. I would also say that we have a reading group, that we look at some of the Gurdjieffian texts and texts of Gurdjieffian teachers like Madame de Salzman and at Parallax, which I started and which you've come into and enriched the group enormously by doing, you know, because of your experience in the work and where people can have hands-on, you know, and do Gurdjieffian style exercises and that kind of thing. So if you're interested in that as well, you can be in contact with me. But a really good place to start would I think would be this course, it seems to me. Might be some sort of starting. It might be the start of something.
Yes. Yeah.